Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Josh Brown, you're beautiful. You're the thing that brightens my life, keeps me going. We're doing a podcast over the Zoom for a change because we're both at home for a random day. But that's not going to stop the wind-up itself. I'm Scott Tilford. You're Josh Brown.
Good morning, Scott Tilford. It's so good to have you back.
Thank you. I met up with my parents yesterday for the first time in a few weeks. I've been away in Japan, as I've said, every waking second of my life since I've been back, and just spouted every single thing at them. Here's every single thing I did. Here's all the photos. Just, you know, when your parents are trying to keep up with like how excited a child is, and they're just, you did that, right? Yeah. Sure, you did that. You had fun. And it was a very lovely time. But I feel like that's literally my entire being has just been, I've been to Japan, you know. And do you know I've been there? Have I told you?
Well, you know what? You've been to Japan for nearly 3 weeks. Of course, you've got to talk about it. You've done so much. You walked 11 miles a day. That's a lot of life experiences to put into 3 weeks. Conversely, Scott, I've done nothing. Yes. I walked probably less than 11 miles in 3 weeks. You know what I mean? So there's quite a gulf between our experiences here.
Usually I wouldn't do 11 miles a year, never mind doing it every other day. There's a lot of stuff to get to. Speaking of things to get to, we're going to talk about various news items that are doing the rounds in the industry as well as a couple of talking points as well. But we should start on some games that we're playing. You've beaten Resident Evil 4 Remake, I believe, 6 times.
Oh, man. Well, with you gone and with little else to do, I finally got to dive into Resident Evil 4 proper, which I briefly touched on in a podcast with Jules and Cy, but I hadn't finished it when we did that podcast. Now, like you say, I finished it 6 times, and I feel like I'm living and breathing Resident Evil 4.
That's
Scott
madness.
Tilford, it really is. I didn't expect this. I thought Resident Evil 4 was going to be similar to the Dead Space remake, whereby I enjoyed it, but I didn't necessarily love it. I could appreciate it as a really great game, but because I've loved that game previously, it's kind of like rewatching a movie. Like, it's still amazing, but does it? Will it count towards Game of the Year 2023? Will it have enough new to really get inside my brain? And here's the thing. While you were gone, I've dubbed something. I've invented a term.
Okay.
Resident Evil 4 hit on something that I'm going to refer to as the Elden Ring pathways in my brain, whereby all I can think about is a game. All I want to play is a game, and I didn't expect Resident Evil 4 to do that to me, but like I said, I've played it 6 times, and even last night, I was playing another game that I can't talk about yet because it's embargoed. I finished it, and the first thing I did was restart Resident Evil 4 again. I'm on it one more time. It is just so moorish. It is hit in a way that I didn't expect. And for me, that just makes it so much better than the Resident Evil 2 remake or even Resident Evil 8 Village games that I love. And like I keep reiterating, wasn't expecting this. Really big surprise.
I know, sometimes we're cut from chemically different cloths because I played Resident Evil 4 just as I was getting ready to leave. And I had a lot of different packing to do and preparation and everything for Japan. So I only put in, you'll know more than me how far through I am. I think it's like a few hours. I've done up until you get to the lake and you get the boat and everything's way more wider open. I think it's just a couple of hours in or something. And my general take was, I don't think it's as good as the original. I didn't like the new feel of the shooting. It's way more oily. It feels way more like just leaden. It feels like Red Dead 2. And I'm sort of like, if you're classing that as like modern controls, I don't know if I'm there for it. So I kind of need to go back to it and just see how it feels like and get further through it, because I've not even met Ashley or anything yet.
Well, honestly, like for the first few hours, I was a little bit worried myself because the first thing that I got caught up on was actually like some of the technical hiccups of the game, for as good as the game looks, I got really bogged down in the weeds of why does this foliage look so bad? Like, why is the... Why
the hair's so weird.
The hair's a little bit weird, though. I do really love hair strands on. I will admit, I came to that conclusion eventually. HDR was a little bit weird. It reminded me a lot of Final Fantasy VII Remake on the PS4, where overall, it was a great-looking game, but when you looked at the smaller details, the quality wasn't there, and there was a big gulf between like the main character models and then the kind of smaller textures that don't really see, but it didn't really stand up to scrutiny. So I kind of got bogged down in that. I got bogged down into, like you said, the heaviness of the gameplay, but then suddenly it kind of all unlocked for me. And while I still love the original, like Resident Evil 4 is one of my favorite games of all time, and it probably is better than this remake. The stuff that you didn't like there that you mentioned, like the heaviness of the shooting, that to me was kind of what made me love it eventually, because I was a little bit worried going into this. How do you live up to the shooting model from RE4 original? You know, we had a conversation about, does the ability to move and shoot and move and reload fundamentally change the tension or whatever? So the first time I kind of shot a zombie and had the resistance on the DualSense and heard like that really kind of heavy pop of the handgun go off, I thought, oh no, they're gonna nail it. They're gonna nail it for me. I genuinely think it's one of like the best implementations of the DualSense yet. So it's gonna break my heart when you tell me you've turned it off. But for me, like we said, chemically different, but it just hits, man. Hits for me.
I need to spend more time with it, and I will. I'm going to go back to it because we're going to have more conversations about it, and it is a huge deal. I just sort of, it was one of those things where I, like you said, I got bogged down in some of the menu stuff where I was like, oh my God, what the hell hair setting am I supposed to be on? Because both of them just look weird in different ways. I just couldn't get them to look right. And then there was like some of the stuff with the brightness, the HDR, like you said, and then like the actual aim sensitivity felt really slow, and I was like, oh my God, I just want to play the game. I hate all the options. I hate that stuff so much. I just want to play, and I love how immediate RE4 original is, and so I got off on such a bad footing with it where I was like, oh my God, I just can't be bothered with all this horrible sludge. Yeah. And then I finally got through that, did a few hours, I was like, yeah, this is fine enough, but I don't enjoy it. It's just not as snappy as RE4 in any sense. Like, you know, they're obviously going for different things.
Totally.
It's a more sort of like, you know, leaden horror, corridor crawly almost experience, but in a bigger, better place.
It definitely is, you know, it doesn't have that, like you said, the immediate snappiness of RE4. To me, I'm pleased it doesn't, because it would have made perhaps the game a little bit too boring and too easy if you had the ease of shooting that you had in RE4. I think the changes are intentional, like you say, and that makes for a more survival horror-based experience, which I wasn't expecting. I thought it was going to be just as action-heavy as the original, if not more, because of, like I said, you know, the freedom and the mechanics that you have now. So those changes worked for me because I did want to be slowed down. And it made the moments later on when I'd upgraded my weapons and could kind of play it as a twitch shooter that little bit more satisfying, because I felt like I'd earned that progression almost over the course of 20 hours or whatever. But ultimately, it's just been a weird experience, because we've talked about this before. When it comes to Resident Evil games, they're like designed to be replayed over and over again. You get all the bonus weapons, all the bonus costumes. You're encouraged to speedrun them, and I never have. I'm a lifelong fan of this franchise. I've played Resident Evil 4 original about 10 times, but I've never replayed it. I've never done a new game plus run of it. I've never used an infinite rocket launcher or anything like that, because I love the core progression. This time around, though, with RE4 Remake, I did all that stuff for the first time. I was speedrunning it in like big stints, 3.5 hour stints. I was using the infinite submachine gun that you get. I was using all of that stuff to kind of get the platinum trophy, and I actually really had a good time. I'm not going to do it for the other games, but this was a pleasant surprise.
Isn't one of the lowest like time trial things to hit like 2 hours or 3 hours or something? It's like burn through it in like 2 to 4 hours.
3.5 hours for the S rank unassisted, and I think it's Jesus. 4 to 5 for standard and hardcore and professional and stuff.
Right.
So you got to get through it fast. And bear in mind, it took me 27 hours to beat the game on my first run. So I was like, how am I going to be able to get it down that much?
It turns out 1/10 of that time.
It turns out when you're not playing it on hardcore and trying to go for all of the trophies and all of the treasures and stuff, you could just absolutely wipe the floor with you know, fully upgraded shotguns and fully upgraded machine guns and stuff. So that was satisfying to shave literally 20 hours of my run to then kind of perfect it. It was an experience I've not had with Resident Evil before, put it that way.
I'm curious about all that stuff, because there's all the stuff with the merchant that was in the original too, in terms of the shooting gallery and trying to get you into that headspace of like a more like arcadey mentality. And I like that idea of like, I have mastered this game because I can just run through it like as much as possible. I'll get back to it. It's just one of those things where there's something, I messaged you this morning, we were talking a little bit on Slack, where I was like, there's something twistedly tragic about the fact that 2023's best games are Resident Evil 4 and Dead Space. And I was just like, they're great games, but like, there's just a big part of my brain that just fundamentally doesn't care that it's right. Just like, here's the thing you've already done again. And it's like, I don't know, you'd have to do more with the remake, I guess. Like Final Fantasy 7, it's a bigger time jump. Like, yeah,
this is it. This is what I'd want to say. And from my perspective, like I really enjoyed the Dead Space remake, but it didn't live with me the same way this did, because it was too similar. This is very similar in the broad sense, you know, like a lot of the levels are one-to-one, a lot of the plot beats are one-to-one, but there was enough change mechanically, and enough change to the story, and enough change to the structure where it felt more akin to Final Fantasy VII Remake. It felt more akin to the original remake of Resident Evil 1, where they kind of overhauled pretty much everything, and it's, some's different, some things are better, but it's kind of like, it feels like a different game, like a proper remake rather than a, you know, a remaster or anything like that. And it kind of, for me, RE4 falls within that purview rather than a Dead Space style kind of approach. Just for me, having taken it in totality, like, I wouldn't recommend, and I think this is quite telling, I wouldn't recommend one over the other. I'd say if you want the full Resident Evil 4 experience, you've got to play the original and you've got to play the remake. Whereas if someone asked me, where should I start with Dead Space? I would say, don't bother with the original, just start with the remake. Yeah,
that's funny. That's ironic, because that is exactly what I would say for Final Fantasy VII. Like, go play the original, then you'll get the remake a lot more. But yeah, I'll get onto that thing in hopefully pretty soon, because I want like a AAA thing, meaty thing to get stuck into. The game I've been playing is Yakuza Kiwami 2, just because it lets me revisit spiritually, lets me go back to the exact parts of Shinjuku that they modeled, that I literally stayed in my hotel and everything. And like, literally, like, obviously the whole Yakuza franchise based around Kamurocho, which is like their take on Kabukicho, which is like this whole sort of series of streets that are quite iconic in themselves. There's a big sign in there that's like replicated in the game. There's a whole thing. So when I got to real life Japan, I kind of felt like I was home, because I've already spent like I don't know, literally like 1,000 hours in the Yakuza games at this point. And so that was phenomenal. So as soon as I got home, I've never actually beat Yakuza 2. So I downloaded the remake. It was like the second one they did in the Dragon Engine, when they went back and like rebuilt everything.
Yeah.
So you've got like way better physics, like enemies just fly across the street, fly through windows, fly into different parts of the environment, which I love. I think we talked about it before. We must have done. I love any game that will let me kick a man into various parts of the environment.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite things to do. And in Yakuza, they very much reward you for that. There's like a few, because you get like special animation finishes. Some of them you can do indoors. So because Kiwami 2 loads all of its interiors all simultaneously, you might be fighting, brawling a dude on a street and brawl into like the 7-Eleven on the corner and then hit your special button. And then you tell the store clerk to put the microwave on, because you want to put a man's head in the microwave. And it never gets more fun than that. And so I've just been living on Yakuza Kiwami 2. It takes place in fictional Tokyo and fictional Osaka. And they are literally this every street corner. I've been back to some of the restaurants I was in. I found the exact seats I sat in and stuff like that. And so outside of that, I'd still recommend Yakuza Kiwami 2 regardless. Like, it's still a brilliant game. I got quite far through it years ago, but I never finished it. But it's just a great brawler with like so many cool little mini games, and the attention to detail for that setting is phenomenal. It's a good time.
You've got a lot of good excuses to keep in that headspace. Like you're saying, you're going through Yakuza now, you're playing a bit of Mario, and then you're going to run that right into Zelda Tears of the Kingdom next month. And then you're going to just be able to, you know, luxuriate in the culture and world of Japan that you've had to sadly leave and come back to the UK, but still experience it via video games. I love that.
Yeah, man, that's the thing. I was like, I know I need to get through Resident Evil 4. That's like, that was my biggest outlier, because that was the thing I was in the middle of when I left. I downloaded Tron Identity, which I did the very beginning of last night, just before we were recording this. Almost immediately fell asleep, but I love the vibes of that game. It's like literally just a Blade Runner visual novel take on Tron. I don't know if you're a Tron fan. I am very much. It's the music's by Dan Lesac. Remember him?
No.
Do you remember Scroobius Pip? I'm just saying words at you now.
No.
Okay,
no,
there was a guy. Some people out there will remember. I'm blanking on the one hit wonder that was Scroobius Pip and Dan Lesak. But they did a song that a lot of people liked about 14 years ago. But it's Dan Lesak doing synthwave music for the Tron game, which I popped at, to use a wrestling term, just because it was such a pull. I was like, Dan Lesak doing stuff. Which I know, again, sounds like the ravings of a madman, but that whole vibe of that game, this whole sort of way more serious take on Tron, which a lot of Tron fans have wanted for decades, just because it is such a, it's a Disney IP, and like the movie wasn't great and whatever. The whole vibes of that game, it's a very like, choose your own adventure type thing. I'm loving that, so I need to play a lot more of it, but I've only done the first sort of half hour or so. But I say it's the vibes, the trench coat in the rain, everything's neon lit. Beautiful.
Scott, here's the thing. I don't know if you agree with this, because, we did say at the beginning of this podcast that, the only real Game of the Year contenders so far are Resi and Dead Space or whatever. Mm. But I'm at this point now, I mentioned this to you briefly before we started filming, but, like, games are coming thick and fast, and I can't keep up with all the games. There's already so many games that I've missed from the start of the year that I want to get to, like Seasons, and I want to get to Like a Dragon Isshin. I want to get back to that as well. There's obviously stuff coming on the horizon. We've got Dead Island 2. We've got Star Wars. We've got Zelda just within the next month alone. And I'm like, how am I going to play all of these games? There's so much that I want to play, and I just feel like I'm going back to back to back. And I know it's not helped by playing Resident Evil 4 six times, but you got to let them breathe as well. And man, I'm feeling a little overwhelmed in a good way right now.
I feel like I need to rediscover 3 a.m. I put 3 a.m. to bed a couple of years ago, and I've not been back there in a while. But that might be the remedy for all this. But we should get through some news items. Very recently, this is a whole Halo bit of news, that Halo franchise creative director Frank O'Connor has left 343 Industries, or at least it's rumored, or it's been picked up on that he has, based on his LinkedIn profile, which now shows NA next to his the former position that he did have. Now, in a wider sense, it's more of just a wider conversation on the state of Halo, which I know we've covered before. There's a couple of news videos and stuff on it. But I did want to mention, this comes after Microsoft laid off 95 people back in January from 343 Industries. There was the single-player story DLC that was rumored for Halo Infinite. Windows Central's Jez Corden literally just tweeted and said it never existed. Just said, Halo Infinite's campaign DLC never existed beyond conversations. Focus has always been entirely on live service. There was never any campaign DLC in active development. So there's a whole thing with just the mismanagement of Halo across the board, and like the fact that, if it was Sony canning 95 Naughty Dog devs, it would be like a massive thing. And I know we've talked about this loads before, but I'm like, this is almost comprehensible, the fact that it got this bad, or is this bad.
It is. It certainly is. It's crazy that it got to this point. At the same time, like you said, because it's been such a slow but continuous decline, hasn't it? I mean, like you said, we've covered this so many times. We covered it when the layoffs initially happened. We covered it last year with James Dowse, when a few of the creative leads went. We probably covered it. I love James Dowse. We probably covered it 5 years ago, when there was a creative reshuffling then. Like, 343 has just been on this decline for so long that at this point, kind of nothing's incomprehensible to me about this studio. When they released the Master Chief Collection and it was broken for years, that felt incomprehensible at the time.
True.
When Halo Infinite got pushed back a year, that felt incomprehensible. Now the idea that studio has been minimized, that kind of felt incomprehensible, but in a way the writing's always been on the wall, and that sucks, because how has Microsoft mismanaged what should be their biggest franchise? And that's the issue, and it just makes me wonder, what do you do from here on out? Do you build 343 back up, or do you just kind of like almost cut losses, put them on something else, see if they can make a new IP, and then give Halo to a completely other team at this point?
Well, that was my thing, because I saw Metro.co.uk did a reader's feature thing where someone had written in and just talked about, like, is Halo dead? Is Halo like a dead franchise after all of this stuff? And it's just like the general sort of like blood in the water type thing alongside the news of the Frank O'Connor stuff, where I was just like, yeah, it is. It's dead. Like, it's been dead for years, and we just haven't really admitted it. Excuse me, we haven't really admitted it. I feel like Halo Infinite's multiplayer was the best thing about it, but the campaign was pretty terrible. Like, it was just really soulless. I don't think you didn't get around to playing it, did you? Like, it didn't even feel like you needed to. You didn't feel like you were missing anything.
No, absolutely not. It felt like, from what I gathered from what you said and from what other people said, it felt like a starting point that is now never going to get built on. So I'm pleased that I never jumped in.
It's just this weird thing, and it's like, just to wrap this whole weird thing up, where it's like, to me, you know, Halo is Xbox, or it was for the longest time. There's a tiny Halo emblem inside every console that they're still shipping right now. Like, you know, if you go inside your Series X or your Series S, you can see a little tiny Master Chief symbol on the chipset, and I think that's like a really cool little touch. But they don't do right by that idea anywhere other than just some hardware person saying, wouldn't it be cool if there was a Master Chief in the every system? And I just think that's just such a weird disconnect. I just kind of can't believe that they would let it fall so much when Halo was so big, that to some degree it's just a case of like verbalizing it is the acceptance side of it. And it's just to have the gaming industry in the palm of your hand for so long, and for the majority of the 2000s, and then to have it fall so stratospherically hard over and over and over again, and then the chief dude is leaving and you lost 95 people, I actually really can't comprehend it. I think it's ludicrous. Like, it's insane that we're here and that they've lost their biggest thing. And yeah. My solution is just to let Halo go altogether. I don't think you can bring it back. I think it's tarnished. I think it needs to die.
I'd like to see them try again, but I also have no problem in letting things like this die. Like, if you do make the comparison, obviously Nintendo will never let anything die. They live and die on their kind of like first party output, their mascots or whatever. But if you look at Sony, they have a lot of first-party games, but they're similarly not afraid to kind of like let things go, or if it's out of their hands and they get things taken from them, like Crash Bandicoot or whatever, they always have something else to plug the gap. Microsoft has Gears, and that's about it. The thing, the main issue with me is not that Halo is dying, it's that over the past decade, they haven't made anything else to take its place. Like, we don't, in my opinion, I don't want the entire industry to stagnate or circle or orbit around a couple of franchises. And when something is not where it once was, it's not at its peak, innovate and bring something else to the table. That's what they did with Gears, but they've not had really anything since on that level. They're doing really good in the racing space with the two Forza series, but like in their AAA space, it's still Halo and Gears. And I don't think we would be talking about how incomprehensible it is to let one of those die if they had anything else across the past 15 years to kind of divert our attention and say, oh, that's what Xbox is in 2023. Xbox is in 2023 what it was in 2005, you know? And that's
I think. I think, yeah, in terms of the output, or in terms of what they want you to think of, like, and that's the thing, assuming that they want you to think of Halo, hence the chipset thing, or they want to remind you of Gears, or they want to make you know the Fable's coming soon, or whatever it is. But that's true. I mean, it's almost like a putting a button on the last 10 years of Xbox just completely failing when it comes to games themselves. And this, I think the thing is, like, obviously both of us grew up with Xbox systems, 360 systems, we talked about this before, but it's because that love was there for so long, and because they did nail it for so long, not the end of the 2000s, when it was all about the Kinect, and they lost their way and everything, but they never came back. Like, it was just the promise of things like Scalebound, and they fell apart and whatever. I just find the whole thing fascinating, and just when the solution is almost you need to let it go entirely for a bit and just see if there's anyone talking about Halo in the next sort of 5-10 years, because every time we do a news video on it, it bombs. Like, it feels like the general populace doesn't care about Halo, which is just a weird thing in itself, you know, considering the history of it. But yeah, speaking of Xbox properties and the idea of things that they had in motion and Scalebound, which is a hell of a segue I'm going to do.
Great,
because because Sony recently did a state of play on Final Fantasy 16, which very much looks like a Scalebound type game. It's an open world game with ostensibly Devil May Cry 5's combat on it, because they've recruited the lead combat designer from DMC5. So this is headed up by Yoshi P. I always forget that dude's name because I confuse him with Yoshinori Kitase. Anyway, that's the dude who did Final Fantasy 14, and this is his first like mainline game, and they did a whole half hour gameplay and they showed everything off. Now, the game is currently like flying up the Amazon pre-order charts and stuff, but there is a back and forth brewing amongst the fandom as to whether it's a Final Fantasy game. And old me doesn't, well, it will be, but old me is very much, when you watch it and you know, you're only going to control one character, you play as a dude called Clive, you can't control anyone else, although you can give them AI prompts, I think, but they very much just do their own thing. It is DMC5 open world, which was kind of the promise of Scalebound, and I think that'll get a lot of people in, hence the pre-orders and everything. But for me, I was like, I don't know if they've gone too far yet. I just need to wait and see how the whole thing feels. But it's fascinating watching it roll out, because I do want massive creative risks for games.
Yes.
But also, Yoshi P talking about, like, how do we get the Call of Duty crowd in, isn't what I want to hear as a lifelong Final Fantasy fan.
This is why I love this podcast. This is why I love this life, Scott Tilford, because Final Fantasy 16 is going to be the first mainline Final Fantasy game that I buy. So, in a way, the developers have actually hit their target of appealing to the Call of Duty crowd, because I'm coming from Warzone and I'm going, oh, I want to see what the crack is over here with this Final Fantasy 16. Do I have to play the 15 of the ones? Probably not. I'm going to be okay.
You never did.
And I'm so excited that I've not even watched the state of play, because I don't want to know anything at this point. I am sold. Mm. The first trailer has completely sold me on it. And like I said, that's monumental for me, someone who has only played through Final Fantasy VII Remake before, because it had such hype and adoration behind it pre-launch in a way that the other mainline games didn't, and it didn't feel like I was missing out on, because it didn't feel like it was my thing. But you say Devil May Cry 5 open world, and I say, how much do you want?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You know?
I know, and I should be saying the same thing, and I'm sure I will in time. My main issue, and you mentioned Final Fantasy VII Remake, my main issue is that when they busted out Final Fantasy VII Remake and we all played it, and that felt like Devil May Cry meets Final Fantasy. It felt like a, you know, because you could take your time in between the menu presses if you want to, you can use the shortcuts if you want to. It played like a hybrid of, you know, like a real-time action game with turn-based stuff, quote-unquote, if you wanted it, because you could just pause the action, pick your spots, pick your spells, and jump between your entire party. And I was like, oh my god, they've finally nailed it after trying all these weird deviations of action combat, whether it be in side franchises like Ni No Kuni or Kingdom Hearts. They've finally got there in terms of a Square Enix published property to make an action game that also feels like a Final Fantasy game. And I was like, oh my god, they finally did it. And then they haven't, I mean, I guess that'll be in Remake 2, but that combat model, I was like, oh, this will be the new Final Fantasy combat model, because they've been striving for something. Even from Final Fantasy 11 onwards, they kept trying different modes of combat and stuff. And 15 was kind of live action, but it was still a bit finicky, and you were holding buttons to do combos. It was a bit weird. So yeah, for me, it was just that 16 is like a step in another weird direction, where you don't keep the team management stuff from Remake, and you don't keep the ability to pause and pick your moves and stuff. It is Devil May Cry in an open world.
I'm coming at this, obviously, from a non-fan perspective. I haven't followed the series like you have. I couldn't even tell you what a Final Fantasy is. You know, like, what is the soul? What makes a game a Final Fantasy game, and what makes it, like, you know, something else with the Final Fantasy branding? But that said, as a kind of, like, as an outsider who wants to get in, I would be a little bit disappointed if it kept the Final Fantasy VII Remake combat intact. Not because I didn't like that combat system, I really did, but because I've already played it, and I will undoubtedly play that again this year with the second part of that. Mm-hmm. And with this being a big numbered installment, again, as an outsider who doesn't have much experience, I'm pleased that it's differentiating itself, that I'm not just going to get a kind of continuation of a game that I played 2 years ago, and then I'm going to play it this December if it hits its release date with Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. To me, like, numbered installments in any franchise need to be big leaps forward, whether that's my beloved Resident Evil going first person for the first ever time. And I like that Final Fantasy 16 is sticking to that, but like I said, it's easy for me to say that as someone with no skin in the game.
Well, the thing is, you know, they've not done... I'm not fully... for me, it's just acknowledging that it does look drastically different, and I applaud the creative side of that. I'm not with the people going, like, oh my God, it looks terrible, because it doesn't. It looks brilliant. It looks beautiful. It looks like an open-world Devil May Cry. And to be fair, you know, when you think about it, they haven't done a dedicated turn-based Final Fantasy. If you discount World of Final Fantasy, which was like a weird little chibi spin-off thing, they haven't done that since Final Fantasy X. So, like, that was 2001 or something. Like, it's a long time, and every single one has been a completely different combat system for the last sort of five main installments. So it's like, it's a weird thing where I completely applaud them for taking the risk, and I'm glad Yoshi P is just like, because he came in sort of almost out of nowhere and resurrected 14. It was almost gonna be a deleted game or whatever, and then built that all the way back up, and then they were like, fine, you can have the next proper one. And he's like, right, I'm gonna make it bigger and better, and I'm gonna get everybody in. And I believe in that dude. But it's fascinating watching it roll out. And the more they show of it, the more it's like, no, we have doubled the F down on this being an action game. Like, you would never know it was a Final Fantasy game if someone just told you it was a different franchise.
Well, this is it. It's always, I think, well, at least for me it is, it's always concerning when you see developers say, we want to go for the GTA crowd. We want to go for the Call of Duty crowd. To me, that just, it screams that you're on the wrong tracks. You know, like, when, again, going back to Resident Evil, when they made a Resident Evil 6 and they wanted all of the Call of Duty crowd, they wanted the Gears of War crowd, and it was the wrong direction for the franchise. But, you know, in this case, it kind of seems to be working. Obviously, there are pockets of the fan base that, you know, don't want this kind of evolution, but like you said, you know, like, sales for it generally are skyrocketing. I think the state of play itself hit like 1 million views pretty much instantly. You know, like, it's people are watching it, people are getting involved in this game, and hopefully it lives up to the excitement that's being put down. But yeah, it's an interesting time, I suppose, to be a Final Fantasy fan, because I feel like you've got a lot of choice. You've got 14, which continues to roll out and be massively popular online. You've got, you know, like, the 7 Remake project that we mentioned there. You've got the Pixel remasters that have just come to PS5
just
and
Xbox.
Out
in 2 days.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you've got Final Fantasy 16. There's a lot of Final Fantasy content to sink your teeth into, and hopefully that means there's enough for fans of any interest to find something that appeals to them.
Well, it's one of those things where, like, in a couple of days, there are the Pixel remasters are all available on the 19th, so that's Final Fantasy 1 through 6. I think they're on Switch and PlayStation initially, and I think they're going to assumedly come to other platforms, but there's that whole weird thing that no one talks about between Sony and Square Enix, where they're clearly just giving each other those handshakes that have, like, £10 notes in, and just to make sure that they get all the exclusives. But yeah, in a couple of days' time, you'll be able to play all 10 dedicated turn-based Final Fantasies, which should satiate that side of you. I mean, that'll be a couple of thousand hours of game, and then that assumedly, you know, maybe frees you up to try something new. I'm definitely up for trying it. I love Final Fantasy so much. I was in the Final Fantasy cafe the other week, and so I'm looking forward to getting stuck in. But I definitely see the side of it that is just them going, like, nah, we're making an action game, and this is what it needs to be, and you know, we think that's the best foot forward. Next news item is that Sega bought Rovio, the dudes that are in charge of Angry Birds, a property that hasn't really done anything in, I don't even know, 14 years, 13, 12 years. It's been a while. So this just happened. This only broke this morning, although there were rumours on Sunday night. But Monday morning, this is written up by the BBC, Sega Sammy Holdings, Sega Sammy are the dudes that own Sega and everything. Sega Sammy Holdings chief executive, Haruki Satomi, says that he wants to use Rovio's distinctive know-how in live service mobile game operations to help bring their own current and new titles to the global gaming market. It's also worth pointing out that Rovio own Beacon, which apparently is like a big mobile platform. And Sega have said that amongst the rapidly growing global gaming market, the mobile gaming market has especially high potential, and it's been in Sega's long-term goals to accelerate its expansion in this field. Now, you know, this is a whole, depends how much you love Sega, whatever, there'll be a Sonic, more Sonic games on mobile, there's already like 50 of them anyway. But I think for me, it's like a wider conversation on pushing into mobile gaming again, like trying to make it so that mobile games in the West are as big as they are in the East, where like, you know, trying to make sure that people are plugged into a certain franchise 24/7. We saw Sony buy a whole bunch of mobile devs. I don't know. What do you think of this whole thing? Mobile gaming is just barely my thing.
Well, same, man. Like, alongside esports, it's one of my biggest blind spots in the industry. Mm. I remember a few years ago, before Microsoft's started to buy Activision, when Take-Two had like the highest gaming acquisition of all time by buying a mobile publisher, and that was news. And even though it was such a monumental thing at the time, like billions and billions of dollars, it wasn't on my radar because I don't have the reference point for that almost. I always forget that it's not just Activision Blizzard anymore, it's Activision Blizzard King. That's how big of a part of that company is, you know. It's crazy. Like, it's an entire mobile division bringing in millions and millions of dollars. You mentioned there the Sony getting into mobile. Nintendo, obviously, you know, put out a bunch of mobile games, would try to get into mobile as well. Sega now making this acquisition. It's like, to me, I'm like, oh man, something's going on over there. And I just hope it doesn't infringe on the stuff that I like. as long as it's not coming over here.
Well, that's my thing, because I remember when Nintendo really tried it across the last few years, and it was, we got a Mario Kart on mobile, we got Super Mario Run, there's the Animal Crossing game that's like terrible, like Pocket Camp or whatever it's called, but it's nowhere near what an Animal Crossing game should be. And then there was the Fire Emblem game, which made a ludicrous amount of money, but again, is a very watered-down version of what that franchise can be. With Sega doing it, I mean, there's already, like I said, there's already a ton of Sonic games on there. Like, the Sonic Dash games are just Temple Run games, where it's an auto-runner and you swipe and move. I already have two of them installed, because I have to play something Sonic based. What am I gonna not play Sonic? And so I've got a bit of that. And I, you know, I assume that they'll want to make new IPs and everything. But I think that whole, like, just push into mobile, like you said, it's a blind spot for the people who it is already a blind spot for. And if you're a mobile gamer, which I'm not, I just have a couple of things installed, mainly Pokemon Go and Sonic if I'm at a bus stop or something. They'll be the people that will be continually monetized. I don't think you can bring people in like us, let's say, to really spend dedicated time on mobile.
That's it. It's a completely different market, isn't it? Like, you might get some people over by using the IP, but they've already used the Sonic IP, and if that's not really worked, it's like, what else can they do? It's just, yeah, it is. It's a huge market, and you can tell why people want to get in on it and why big publishers want to get in on it, because there's so much money to be made. It's just like, it's almost completely different from the quote-unquote hardcore gamers that would go insane for a Sonic Mania 2 or whatever.
I did just think, if you do a Sega All-Stars Angry Birds and I can fling little Kazuma Kiryu heads at tiny little Majima heads, I'd actually pay for that. Yeah. You'd have to restrain me to stop me paying for that.
I might have done that in 2008. Maybe not now, but maybe back then.
Bring back, what was it, Doodle Jump? Bring back, yes. Doodle Jump. Put Sonic on that thing. Final news thing, which is actually something that's sort of just still taken over from last week, which is just the general conversation on frame rates in games. This came after Redfall, or Arkane rather, developers of Redfall announced that the game will be launching at 30 FPS with a 60 FPS patch coming further down the line. And then more recently, archivists have gone on to the used Wayback Machine or whatever the hell they used to look at old versions of web pages to find that the Xbox store was listing Redfall as 60 FPS plus. And so technically, I guess legally, that's still true, because it might still get there eventually. But it's just that general conversation on, because it's also backed up by John Hanneman over on Digital Foundry, saying that 30 FPS games are coming back. The 30 FPS just is the norm, and the quicker we accept that, the better. That's my paraphrase of his general argument. That's an interesting thing, because we have consoles that are trying to push 60, we have consoles pushing 120, we have boxes for the PS5 that say 8K that we're never going to get there. And I wonder whether, you know, more marketing gets put into just locking 30 FPS, convincing the mass populace that 30 can be acceptable, and then we focus on visuals, or is it the other way around? Do visuals need to take the hit so we can actually lock 60 in?
I'm going to offer, after slagging them off earlier on, I'm going to offer a tepid defense of Microsoft here, because I do think this is going to become standard, like you said, and like that Eurogamer piece kind of stated as well, because if you just like look historically at how developers and how console makers have kind of like pushed the 30 FPS as norm, not agenda, but approach to developing video games over the past years, we've always had machines that could get 60 frames per second, but at the cost, at the often drastic cost of visual fidelity. Now, at the launch of the Xbox Series X and the PS5, when we've had a bunch of multi-platform titles, like, when was the last time we had a dedicated PS5 game from Sony? A long time ago. You know, they kind of prioritized this hybrid model, but there was never a doubt in my mind that I reckon there's a 70% chance that the next Naughty Dog game doesn't have a 60 frames per second option. You know what I mean? Maybe eventually, but not at launch, I don't think. And that's just going off how the company has operated before. For instance, when they put out the remaster of, you know, The Last of Us 1 on the PS4, and that had the option for 60 frames per second. But then you got The Last of Us Part 2 and it was locked at 30 because they wanted to push the graphical, you know, features and stuff. And I just think console gamers, console makers and console developers have always prioritized that stuff. And while you might get a kind of insomniac approach where you kind of patch in a bunch of stuff after the fact, which I still think will happen, I think the base versions of the biggest games, especially from Sony, more so than Microsoft, I'd say, are going to be pushing visual fidelity, are going to be locking those frame rates down. And is that a shame? Probably. But I don't think it'll be for every game, but I do think Redfall is not going to be the only controversy we have surrounding a 30 FPS lock for the rest of the generation. I think it's going to become more and more commonplace as we push the tech to its limits.
No, same. I wonder, I would rather they just rip the Band-Aid off and just said, like, look, like, you know, we can't actually balance. Because I just saw another headline that was Capcom have removed ray tracing from the Resident Evil 2 and 3 remakes, at least on PC. Some patch that happened overnight or something removed that feature from the game. And I wonder, those things, the ray tracing, the volumetric lighting, all these buzzwords, all these terms that we use to big up the visuals, we never really had the conversation about how that impacts frame rate. We just sort of accepted that everything would be brilliant and we could do all these cool visuals with an incredible 120 frames a second and it'll be in 8K 120. Like I said, we're just never going to get there. And I would rather have that conversation or that admittance, I guess it would be at this point, or something like that, to just say it's going to have to be one or the other and maybe spec towards that. For me, it's always just about responsiveness. Like, I think if you can have a locked 30, I'm totally fine with that, because at least it feels consistent and it feels like I can, you know, and after, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes with a game, you get like used to it anyway. It becomes that sort of symbiotic connection with it anyway. So for me, it's all about consistency of frame rate rather than like higher is better by default. For me, it's just consistency. Gotham Knights, and absolutely, obviously that game launched like hell. They patched quite a lot of it, but it never got above 30. But thankfully now it is locked at 30. And so as one of the five people who like that game anyway, it does actually run a lot better than it ever did before. But what do you think of that stuff? What do you think of like fixed frame rate? Can that get around the 60 thing for you?
It's fine for me. Like, again, I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who like isn't ride or die on 60 frames per second. I really like having the option, but I'm a quality mode man through and through more often than not. I played Resi 4 on quality mode. I played the Dead Space remake on quality mode. I will probably play the next Naughty Dog game on quality mode. And I probably would have played Redfall on quality mode if I had the option anyway. I think it's more a conversation about like optimization and how difficult that can be for some AAA studios, whether it's they don't have the resources or more importantly probably they don't have the time to fully optimize games. And I think that's the main reason why we don't have like these options standard at launch anymore. You mentioned Gotham Knights there, which is exactly what I was going to bring up. Like, that was a next gen only game that cut ties with the last gen consoles, and it still wasn't optimized to hit 30 frames per second at launch, you know what I mean? And I look at Redfall, which again is a game that doesn't look very visually cutting edge in my opinion, but I imagine the performance is being tanked hard by the online component, kind of like how Gotham Knights was. So I wonder whether that's been difficult to optimize for. It's just a case of optimization and how much time these developers have and how beholden to deadlines they are. You know, I think it's telling how much work it is by just looking at Gotham Knights and realizing that, yeah, we cut off all of these other machines and we still didn't hit the target, you know? Development is hard. Surprise, surprise.
The thing is, as well, I don't know. Actually, I'm going to just hazard a guess that the average person doesn't even care or even talk about frame rates. Like, people like us will notice it. Obviously, there's millions of us online talking about video games, noticing this stuff, arguing about this stuff. But I think most people sit down, they buy the games they want to play, they sit down and they play them. And even if they've been involved in some online conversations, it's always going to be in when they start playing, does it feel good? Does it feel like it's juddery? Like, how noticeable is that? And I think you can get away with like maybe two or three frames like fluttering around the 30 mark. But it's always that, it's weird because when you get to 25, you can tell. And it's always that weird little mark where it's sort of in between that it's okay. On films like 27 or something?
Films are 24, I want to say. Right. Films are 24 and I think TV is 25. There's like a weird discrepancy between them, but yeah.
So there's definitely something in that 20 mark where it's sort of like, but even we're talking like literal numerics at some point, but it's like, if you can lock it down, I think, like I said, for me, it's entirely about responsiveness.
Yeah,
and consistency.
I fully agree. I mean, you know, going back to the Dead Space comparison, that in 30 felt so much better than Callisto Protocol in 30, which did feel janky and awful and unresponsive, and you were better off playing that game in frame rate mode. Whereas for Dead Space, for whatever reason, they just implemented it so well that it was smooth and it was responsive and they nailed it. That's what they need to get if they want to convince people that 30 FPS is okay, because there's nothing worse, and I've had it with the Resident Evil 4 remake, when a game comes out and it's trying to hit 30 and it doesn't, and then it gets stuttery in like the big set pieces and you're like, God, why does my PS5 feel like a, you know, 2003 Windows PC that's trying to run a modern game? You know, it shouldn't feel like that. This should be next gen.
That's definitely the core of it. The amount of money that we're putting on these systems, and that it's that vague promise of next gen solving all the issues of the current gen, and then just having to look down the barrel of that and be like, actually, we can't match the visuals with the frame rate. But I mean, there's a whole, I'm not going to it now, but there's a whole wider conversation for me on how big the industry's got and how much we're focusing on visuals. And obviously we've talked about that so many times before. I would rather they reduce the visual fidelity to ramp up the responsiveness with the frame rates. Something like a Sifu is almost my perfect example of a video game, or Hellblade or something, where it's like, you know, it didn't take them 8 years to make it. It's not a Rocksteady Suicide Squad situation. It's just a focused video game designed to be played and beaten that performs well.
I think, you know, this is no slight in PC players, but PC players have had such options, so many options for so many years, are used to, you know, cranking the FPS up to the 200s, able to tweak every kind of like last setting. And now as console players, we've had a taste of that with the new generation of consoles. You know, for better or worse, some people love it. Some people, like yourself, Scott Tilford, hate being inundated with hair strands and, you know, chromatic aberration and all of those you know, menus and stuff. But I wonder now whether we have got to a point in the console space where that is so solidified that anything else now is going to be viewed as a negative. You know, if we never had those options to start with, and Redfall came out and announced that it was 30 frames per second and was going to get an update later on, I don't think anyone would have batted an eye. But in this kind of weird interim period where we're getting all of these multi-platform games, cross-gen games, and we've kind of made these options the norm, now to suddenly kind of strip those away, it does feel like you're getting less, and it does feel like the games are quote-unquote worse, because from like, maybe even if it's just like an optics thing, but that's been established.
Yeah, man. Well, for me, it's the dichotomy of the console promise. The console promise was to do away with that stuff, do away with all the finicky PC stuff, and just give you a system and a game, and it worked. That was what even Steam tried to do with the Steam, the Steam Machine or whatever it was called in 2013, 2014. Yes. The idea of just, we'll give you the box and you don't have to worry about it. It just plays stuff. That's always what the Steam Deck does too. And I feel like we're up against that with the console promise versus as we get more towards PC tech and bigger games are demoed on PC and they bring them across. And then some games on Switch especially, you punch in a few different button codes and you can just bring up the PC menu. Like, there are some indie games that just are literally the PC version, and you're just piloting the mouse cursor around with the analog stick. And so things like that, I think the console promise is kind of waning in terms of like the immediacy of it. And it's like, we're in this weird Venn diagram thing where it's this weird gray area, and where they want to give us a bunch of PC style options, but you have the what should be the immediacy of consoles butting up against that. I literally spent 20 minutes when I first booted up Resident Evil 4 googling what am I saying, what's the best thing for
me
this
too.
And I hate that. And it's just the black levels thing all over again on the TV, where it's just like, can I just watch the thing? And then you realize 10 years later that you had it set wrong, and you've got to get the ambient lighting on the go, make it work. But I always want the immediate thing. And I feel like that's kind of where we are with conversations like this, where they're just saying, we can immediately give you a 30 FPS thing, but there's this thing in the industry overall that says, like, well, why not 60? I thought that's what the immediate thing was. And now we're at this butting heads bit.
I wonder how much of it, though, it is just we need to get this game out, because Redfall, correct me if I'm wrong, was already delayed. That was supposed to come out at the end of last year. So it's already been delayed once, and I wonder whether they're looking at the game and going, well, we could get a 60 frames per second option or higher, 120 frames per second option in there, but it means we'd have to delay the game another month. Should we not just push a version of it out now and patch it later? Because, you know, other teams have done that, Insomniac, and it's been fine, but obviously this has been received a lot worse. And I wonder whether, you know, that's a conversation going on within all of the teams right now. I wonder if something similar happens to Starfield when that eventually comes out, where you might have originally envisioned or planned multiple options to play that game performance-wise, but it kind of gets down to the wire and you think, man, we need to kick this game out. We can't delay it again. Let's just patch the rest of the stuff in after launch.
I tell you what as well, just to round this up or whatever, that's the Insomniac show I was going to mention, because they put out the Miles Morales, the performance ray tracing mode. If they'd literally said during the game's development that actually at launch it's going to be one or the other, or later we'll have the option for both, optically that would have not gone down very well. I feel like it's kind of almost an optics problem in this regard. Maybe they would have been better off just not saying anything. But I guess then you would have had the at some point had to make that call of whether you educate people beforehand or not. But yeah, teams that have added meaningful graphics options later, they tend to just not talk about it, and then it's a nice surprise when you can do something, even though retroactively or retrospectively, it is terrible that wasn't there on day one.
Yeah, because ultimately, I don't think these developers want people waiting for a quote-unquote optimum version of the game. Like, if I knew that ray tracing performance mode was coming out for Miles Morales, maybe I'd have waited to play the game. Maybe I'd have thought, well, that's the best way. That's the best of both worlds. That's how I want to play the game. I'll wait and get it. They ultimately do just want you jumping in as soon as possible. And I wonder how the messaging surrounding these patches and these different modes is going to evolve over time, because at some point it'll go back to the thing of, well, it's just player choice. That's all we want. We just want to add in. It's not because we couldn't hit the deadline or the publisher refused to move the deadline. We just want some more choice in the game, you know?
It's not because we have no idea what our first party teams are doing. Maybe they have a game. That's another thing, is that they just need games. So it's like, just can you just get this out? So something is on a shelf somewhere for someone to buy. Anyway, we'll check back in the coming weeks as things develop in many different fields. For now, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tailford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tailford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you once again. And we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.